I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're going to kick things off today in a country we don't often go to on a map of Africa. Burundi is a little hard to find if you don't know where it is. But our first two guests know the Central African country very well and are seriously worried about what's going on there.
You almost want to hold the globe and shake it and say, look at what's happening.
That's Burundian poet Keti Nivyabandi. She led all women protests through the streets of the capital Bujumbura last spring. We'll hear more from her and why she's so angry in a few minutes. One of the reasons has to do with something Amnesty International revealed today. Satellite images that seem to show five new mass graves near the capital. If confirmed, they're likely the result of fighting there since April. That's when Burundi's president announced he would run for a third term, ignoring a constitution that barred him from doing so. Our first guest is the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power. She was in Burundi last week and had her own brush with government officials. When she tried to talk with reporters at Bujumbura's airport, officials tried to push them apart. You can see her on YouTube telling them, don't touch me, I'm talking to the press, I can do what I want. And she did.
Held a press conference, but I think we also got a window into some of the darker tendencies that exist in that country and with the government right now.
Those darker tendencies have created a climate of fear in Burundi that Ambassador Power describes as acute.
What you have so far are hundreds of people who have been killed, people in Bujumbura, the capital, waking up most mornings and seeing bodies in the streets, 240,000 refugees who have fled to neighboring countries, and a climate of widespread fear that the crisis could escalate and that a match could be laid down, lighting up whole communities that so far have stayed peaceful. One of the reasons that the international community and the African Union are so seized with the challenges in Burundi right now is because we know the history and we see things escalating and not de-escalating, and we see people becoming more fearful, and people in the part of government militias, but also in some in the opposition, becoming better armed, and that does not bode well. So we can't say it is a genocide, but I don't think that one would be exaggerating the crisis on the ground by saying that we worry that history could repeat itself in Burundi.
There have been lots of allegations that neighboring Rwanda is training and supporting opponents of Burundi's government. Did you see any evidence of that?
Well, our mobility was restricted so much by the government that I cannot say that we had the kind of exhaustive look at the situation on the ground. But we believe the reports of Rwandan involvement are credible, and we have exerted public and private pressure on Rwanda to do nothing to further destabilize a situation that really could get out of hand in a hurry.
Well, you tried to follow up, I gather, with activists and others you'd met on a previous trip to Burundi. What did you learn about these people?
Just looking at the list of journalists, human rights defenders, women's rights activists, lawyers, etc., that I had met with on my first trip in my current job in April of 2014 versus now, a year and a half later. And when I went down the list, basically next to each of the names of the individuals I'd met, it was a stark catalog of how much the situation had deteriorated. So next to one name, it would say fled, the next one fled, the third one in hiding, the fourth one in Burundi, but not at the meeting, too scared to come to the meeting, the fifth one shot, Pierre Clavier Mbomina, one of the great human rights defenders in Burundi, was shot in the throat and in the face and is recovering in Brussels. It is not just what civil society said or didn't say to the UN Security Council when we visited, but what is left of civil society, and do they even feel free to come forward and engage with the international community in order to share their concerns? And the answer is, by and large, not.
I mean, given the number of crises that the UN seems unable to deal with, refugees, Syria, ISIS, whatever, where the U.S. is hardly leading from the front or from behind, are the kinds of genocide prevention mechanisms you've long called for possible?
Well, I think that there are a range of things that the Obama administration has done, the UN have done, that actually increase our preparedness to respond to mass atrocities. It's now routine that we would set up a commission of inquiry and name names. It's routine that we would put in place arms embargoes in different crisis situations to try to stem the flow of arms, high-level engagement by the President of the United States or by the Secretary of State or myself preventively now happens as a matter of course, even in places that aren't right smack dab in the middle of what the American people are thinking about every day, you know, like some of these, the Central African Republic or Burundi, are not areas that citizens think about that often in this country. And yet we try to examine the tools in the toolbox, see what can be deployed, what might make a difference. The fact of the matter is the system is bursting at the seams with more than 60 million displaced persons. Conflicts are lasting much longer than they used to. The average refugee used to be displaced under 10 years, and now that's up near 20 and counting. So we've invested more humanitarian assistance in trying to help those who are fleeing conflict, who are living in conflict areas. But the demand is outpacing the supply of resources. And we deploy mediators, but just because you deploy a mediator and energetically work to get peacekeepers deployed doesn't mean that the president of a country is inclined to put his people first. And so fundamentally, the purpose of a lot of those atrocity prevention measures is to ensure that we never leave a tool in the toolbox that we might employ that might make a difference. But at the end of the day, we also need leaders in these countries to be responsible and to put the welfare of their people first.
The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Burundian Keti Nivyabandi never expected to become a political activist. She's a poet, an essayist, and a parent. But when Burundi's president dug in his heels last April and decided not to leave office, violence erupted. Keti and some of her friends decided to lead their own all-women's protest, a peaceful one. But the government did not see it that way.
We were tear gassed. They brought huge water cannons at us. At one point, actually knelt in front of a water cannon, and it was still, shooting straight at us. And the police was heavily armed. And, here we were, women singing our national anthem, having our white handkerchiefs and walking peacefully. We presented no threat to the police.
Yeah.
But the level of repression was absolutely unspeakable.
So you were resolute. Were you frightened? What were the other women feeling?
To tell you the truth, when I first saw all these policemen, fully armed and the water cannons and the tear gas, I was scared. I was terrified. But I also understood right there in that moment that this was a decisive time, that we could not keep running away. That if we run away today, we'll run away forever. At some point, you have to stand up and overcome the fear in order to defend what it is that you think is right. So despite the fear, despite the violence, we stayed together and we said to ourselves, at the end of the day, this is tear gas, these are water cannons. Even if they shoot us, we have to stand for the truth and we have to stand for the dignity and integrity of the country. So the fact that we were together and comforted each other gave us strength. And personally, having organized this, I couldn't go back. I looked at these women and said, we cannot go backwards. We have to go forth. We have to, finish what we started.
And you're a mother, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am.
How did you explain what was happening to your children? What do you say to them to not scare them?
Right. And because they've been hearing this, they actually saw pictures. But what I tell them is that, your country and your values, your principles, your beliefs are stronger than the fear that you feel. And I tell them that, what I'm doing is for them, for them to be able to live in a Burundi where they're free, where they're able to, fully bloom and blossom. And that it will also be their responsibility when they are older to make sure that justice and freedom are upheld. You can't just sit by as a citizen and watch as injustice is being done to other people. We are responsible for each other's peace and stability and a sense of justice. I think that's the lesson that I want to leave with them.
You said there was no going back with your activism, but you fled Burundi to Canada, which is where you are now. What happened? Mm-hmm.
So after our demonstration, what happened is that a coup was attempted in Burundi, and it actually happened while we were on the streets, which was quite something, and the coup failed. So immediately after that, a very severe repression started, and we all knew that we were all in danger. The reason I fled was because I had children, quite honestly. Mm. My kids had left Bujumbura just a few days before the crisis started. They were in the neighboring Rwanda. And I knew that if I stayed longer, I risked my life. I also risked not being able to see them for a long time. But I think if I didn't have children, I certainly would not have left. But I would also, in most likelihood, be dead by now. But I'm not the only one. So many others have had to flee the country. You know, all anyone really who has a strong opinion or who has... Was it an intellectual, an artist, a human rights defender, a politician? You know, anyone who has a voice and raises it has had to leave the country.
You're living with this on a daily basis in Canada. How hard is it to be so entwined with what's happening back home, something so close to you, and not to be home?
It's a very, very difficult situation. I can't begin to explain it. Because first you're dealing with the heartache and the hardship of exile, which in itself is traumatic. It's hugely traumatic, you know, becoming a refugee. And as you go through that, you're seeing on a daily basis what's happening and you feel powerless. You want to do something, but you can't. You're confined in this exile and in this very limited space. As a writer, as a poet, I find it extremely hard to even write about it. So I find myself just keeping busy in the day-to-day activism, and it's a very hard situation to go through.
What is the role of a poet when so many lives are at stake?
I find myself asking the same question. You carry forward the cries, the anguish of the people. You become that voice, or one of the voices, for that hurt and that pain. That's one thing. But at the same time, looking at, again, at my countrymates, you do want to offer something for them to hang on to. So you are torn between becoming a sort of a wall of lamentations, between singing the pain and also singing the beauty of Burundi, to remind them of what we are and as a people, of what we can be and why we are fighting anyway. So it's a conflicting and blurry line. But ultimately, I think a poet's role is to be as true as possible to what one is experiencing and is feeling inside, and to express it to the best of our ability. That's the small contribution that you can give.
Burundian poet and activist Keti Nivyabandi led an all-female street movement in the capital, Bujumbura. She's been speaking with me from Calgary, her home in exile. Keti, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, too. Thank you very much.